Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and it's time for another meeting of our book club. And Larry Mueller Show Book Club, we have a criteria for it. First, it should be a good book, but it should be also set in Wisconsin, or it should have a Wisconsin author, or both. And we have the trifecta here with Michael Knadler, the author of our book today. He grew up in a Wisconsin River village. He lives a few miles from the river in rural Dodgeville. Michael taught high school in Dodgeville for 30 years, during which time he published a novel for teens. That one was called Callie's Way Home. And as we talk with him about his latest novel, it's titled Bridgeton. What are your memories growing up in a small town in Wisconsin? Have you spent lots of time on the Wisconsin River, maybe? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Again, love to hear from you. Michael Knadler, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Larry. It's a privilege to be here.
Well, I was privileged to read your book, and I enjoyed it very much. What inspired you to write it?
Well, I'll talk a little bit about the origins, and it really began in my teaching career when I had lots of students who were interested in varying degrees to what I might be saying. And I would tell them stories to interest them, entertain them, also to try to inspire them to write better narrative essays. And so I would present instances from my past, some made up, some exaggerated, but you know that's how storytelling works. And so I had a few of those made it into the book, some didn't. But then after I retired, I started writing some of those stories down. They were about these boys when they were 10 years old. And in that process, the three characters who inhabit this book arose out of my imagination, Mickey, Jimbo, and Lemon. And they and so that it was, in the beginning, just a coming-of-age story, which are very common types of fiction. Mm-hmm. And then as I morphed it into their lives as young teenagers and older teenagers, I said, I'm going to go for this. I'm going to take them to my age, which was around 70. And so then I strategically started presenting episodes, creating episodes that took them in along the way with those passages in the adult world, you know, what happens after you get out of high school, marriages, having children, the work you do, and then inevitably the deaths that are around you. And so it became a story of time passing and death arising. And there are a number of deaths that I handle and that affect these characters. But in the end, they come together as 70-year-olds, not in Bridgeton, which is where they grew up, but in the Twin Cities, and they are, in a sense, have turned inward and are good friends who will sustain each other, theoretically, until they themselves die.
Yeah, it's an interesting approach you took. I was fascinated this as I was reading along. I was thinking, you know, almost every chapter could be a short story in and of itself.
Yeah, no, they function that way, and there are some threads that that go through it, and most of the key characters have a follow-up, kind of a coda at some point in the last part of the book to see what happens to them. But they are, but the key characters, particularly Mickey, who's the narrator for most of it, they sustain it as they experience these relationships. It's, you know, it's very much a character study of these three boys who grow into men.
Yeah. If take us on a trip through Bridgeton. if you were to walk around Bridgeton, what would you see?
Well, Bridgerton, in a sense, is modeled after my hometown of Mosinee. And amusingly, I had one friend who read the book, and when he was done, he said he spent several hours Googling Bridgerton and could not find it. So that was kind of a compliment to me. But it's a paper mill town. It was when I was growing up in the 50s and early 60s. I lived a block away from the river and the bridge, and if you are looking at the book, the picture of the bridge on the cover, which spans the front and the back cover, that is the bridge that I grew up with. And in the book, I affectionately refer to it as Old Iron, but as a kid, that was never the case. So across the river was the paper mill, which was the lifeblood of the town. And part of the river ran down to a power plant. And the downtown had a couple grocery stores. My father, who was a small-town doctor, had his office there next to my grandfather's office, and my grandfather owned a small telephone company. And so I use references to those in the book. There was a skating rink, which is featured in a number of the stories.
Yeah.
At Desert Park. There was a place that we used to prowl around in called Skunk Hollow, which was reinvented for this book. And, you know, the schools were small. The grade school, which was right across the street from the Catholic grade school, they inhabited the same playground. And so it was small-town America, 1,400 people or so when I was growing up. And rarely did we think of going to Wausau or Stevens Point, which were the meccas that we would go to on those special occasions. Now, Mosinee has become more like a bedroom community for Wausau.
Yeah, which shows up kind of in the book.
Yes,
near the end. Well, and characters, I mean, you've got the three main characters, and they all come from families, of course. I looked up, I counted. There are 33 characters from within the families. And then there's another dozen or so that aren't members of the family, but many of those dozen play an important role in the book. How'd you manage all those characters? You know, it was interesting to me how you managed them. But when you're writing something like that, and I will also say, I love the fact that in the beginning, you list the characters by family. And I'll admit, there's more than a couple times that I went back because I'd forgotten a particular Daisy. Where's Daisy again? I could go right back and, oh, of course, find that.
Yeah, that was actually my wife's suggestion, so I compliment her on that. But there were a number of people who said, I was so happy you had that, the listing of the characters. But juggling the characters was never too hard, and the fact that I knew for most of them, they would reappear in some future moment when they were adults and we'd pick up on who they were later on was something that made it easier to juggle them. They weren't just one-offs. A few are one-off characters, but for the most part, the key people reappear at least a second time, and that made it comfortable for me to do further development with their character.
Couple of comments. Nancy sent us a note, read Bridgerton last year, loved it so much that she put it on her Kindle after owning the hard copy. The storyline initially took her back to when one of the biggest issues for a preteen was whether or not they would have to be home before the streetlights came on. And Nancy appreciates how, Michael, how you revisit the various characters as they navigate the changes and the impacts on their town. And by the time the story ended, she felt a kinship with the main characters. It was like wrapping herself in a favorite cardigan, which is nicely put. The perspective of the main character change in alignment with the development changes he underwent was interesting. Even the verbiage and the style seemed to transition from the linguistic level of preteen to adult. Was that intentional, is her question?
Well, part of it certainly was. The early stories when the boys are 10. There's maybe eight or nine when the boys are 10 years old and pretty much amazed by life, even though some of them, particularly Jimbo, is going through some trauma. But as they become older, the experience they have are more sophisticated. Their thinking becomes more sophisticated. There's a story in there called Fragments, which is kind of about Mickey becoming a writer to some extent. And his mentor tells him, you know, keep at it, and fragments, your fragments in your mind will become longer and longer sentences as your voice speaks to you, which then transitions into him kind of writing his first story. And that story is about one of the few things in the book which is real, about my Aunt Margaret, who was severely burned in a Halloween accident.
Mm.
And but he's writing about what he knows about. And so that one was somewhat easy for me to take on, even though my aunt has been dead for many years. But yeah, the stylistic thing becomes more sophisticated. And then as they contemplate the mortality issues as they get older, you know, the thoughts become very complicated.
Yeah.
As it does for all of us.
Yeah. Oh, she's also wondering if there's a sequel, and is there an audio version? Did you? You have a great voice, by the way. You could do the audio on it, I think.
Well, there's no audio version. If you want to invite me to your book group, I'd be very happy to drop my voice in.
Well, you know, there's some more emails here, but you ought to drop your voice in. Do you have got something you'd read for us from the book?
Oh, sure, yeah. And what I'll read is, it's a passage from the second chapter. And this actually did happen, and I'll talk about that after I read the passage, about a good example of how I used a real event in my life as part of a storyline. Okay, so here we go. It's the story of a little baby found on the kitchen table in Mickey's home. Mickey's spending the night with his friend Jimbo, and Jimbo's father is the town doc McPherson. So here we go. I was sleeping on the carpeted floor in Jimbo's bedroom when I first heard the wailing. I rolled over to go back to sleep, but her crying ascended through the heating grate near my head. Jimbo and Lemon were buried in sleeping bags across the floor, still breathing deeply. I rose and slowly opened the door, pausing on the stairs when I heard Doc McPherson's soothing voice, "I'm so sorry, Bev." I peered into the kitchen lit only by the under-the-cupboard fluorescent. Beverly Schuster was shuddering and gasping. Doc's flashlight inspected Lucy, the naked baby on the table, Beverly's two-month-old infant. She lay motionless on her back in the middle of a turquoise blanket. The movement of Doc's light beckoned as Beverly leaned forward against the kitchen table, her hands clutching Lucy's legs, stroking them, pinching them. Lucy was soundless with a dull bluish skin tone. She drew me closer by her inactivity. Beverly rubbed Lucy's belly, pleading with her, "Lucy, wake up." I stood next to Doc as he tried to console her. "She was dead within seconds after she stopped breathing," Doc said. "I had just nursed her 20 minutes earlier. It can happen that quickly." When I reached out toward Lucy, Doc's oversized paw enveloped my hand and pulled it back. Beverly noticed me for the first time and half smiled through her tears. "Hi, Mickey. It's okay. You can touch her. Here, let me help." She cupped my right hand in both of hers. We fondled Lucy's fingers, sliding up her mottled arm to her fleshy neck. Beverly was no longer crying, whispering at my earlobe, "Feel her face." I looked back at Doc, Lemon in front of him now, uncombed blonde hair, sweeping over his forehead, Jimbo, burly and nearly a head taller than Lemon and I, at his dad's shoulder, both of them fully awake, saucer-eyed in awe at our first encounter with death. Lucy's eyes were half-closed, unfocused, her mouth barely open at the corners. I caressed her velvet cheek with my index finger. My thumb felt no air from her nose, and the heat fleeing her body seemed palpable. Beverly sang lullaby and goodnight as she lifted my hand away and scooped Lucy up. She held her near my face, then Lemon's, finally Jimbo's. "See," She stopped breathing, just like that. Doc, unnerved now by Beverly's actions, spoke very faintly, "Boys," and we moved to the back wall of the kitchen. 3 10-year-olds in white briefs, speechless, lit up by the faint tangerine of dawn edging through the kitchen windows. Doc finally escorted Beverly and Lucy away from us into his office. A version of that actually happened to me. I was 12, and it was summertime, as it is for these boys, and I heard some noise from the kitchen, and I walked down, and my father was there with the woman who was his office worker in his small-town doctor's office. And she was wailing, and my dad was trying to comfort her. And her baby was on the table dead. It died of what they called then crib death, now called SIDS. And I didn't do anything more than just observe.
Yeah.
The rest of the story that I've created here is manufactured for the benefit of the story and the character development. But certainly it's a memory that has stayed with me.
You know, I'm glad you chose that piece. Because it's a beautiful piece of writing. And very touching. And here I see an email from Jane. "The oftentimes poetic language and reminiscent storyline were really engaging. It was sort of like vignettes that you could be read on their own." And she's going to recommend Bridgeton to her book club because they are all from this time period of the story, which of course started in the 50s.
Right. Well, get a hold of me. I'd be very happy to join you in the book club discussion.
Our guest today, Michael Knader, his book is Bridgeton, the title. And I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts. We have some more emails here as well, but you can join us at 800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. On WPR News, it's the Larry Mueller Show Book Club, and our book club selection this time around is from Michael Knadler. He has written the book Bridgeton, a wonderful novel of basically of three friends growing up in a small town, the town of Bridgeton, along the Wisconsin River. Questions or comments for him, or maybe an experience of your own to share, the number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. And you were going to make a comment, and I just sort of broke in.
Well, one of the things I was going to comment on was... I think it would be natural for many readers to believe this is my memoir.
Yes. Well, I was going to ask you about that.
Because I've, in a sense, deliberately thrown in a bunch of cues that would make somebody believe that. And in fact, towards the end of the book, I even mentioned as Mickey's trying to wrap up this book as he's 70 years old, that he's trying to put the final touches on this memoir. But it's not a memoir. It's the spirit of it is a memoirish for sure.
Yeah.
But the only a few instances in my past made it into the book, and only a couple of characters. The rest is pretty much my own invention. But I think there's a lot of reasons why people fall in love with memoirs, especially people of a certain age, as Larry and I are sitting here, because we become very reflective when we reach a certain point in life about all the things that have happened to us, good and joyful and sometimes sorrowful, back to when we were young and maybe they were pivotal moments in our life and sent us in a different direction, or when we're older, and that often relates to somebody important to us leaving us, often by death. And so it was very moving for me as a writer and very entertaining as well to write about those moments as these three guys move on from just being Bridgeton buddies to becoming adult friends.
Yeah. I'll tell you on myself, I grew up with, I had three friends, boys, that were friends of mine, and two of them have passed away. Roger is still left. But we did a lot of, you know, similar things. I mean, going out, and there was a hill that we would kind of run, go up at night sometimes in the summertime and just take a blanket and lay down and go to sleep and spend the night there. And our friendship has lasted. And the other two, Dick and Jerry, they're passed away now. But, I mean, we've all were friends for all those years.
Yeah, it's such a common phenomenon. And some people aren't that lucky, like you were and are, to have friends that you sustain through the years. Often those friendships end at when high school graduation occurs. But you know, this is very much a story of friendship and how friendship sustains each other through the ups and downs of life. And so it was fun. The places along the river, as I mentioned, I grew up for most of my time in Mosinee, a block away from the river. And so the bridge was essentially my backyard. But not every place I use in the book, like Discovery Beach, for instance, that was not a part of my youth. In fact, Discovery Beach is more akin to the beaches along the sandbars of the river from Prairie du Sac on down to the Mississippi, where there's no more dams after Prairie du Sac. But you know, Bridgeton, as Mosinee is and was, is part of that whole paper mill dam culture of dams creating flowages, and so there aren't really so many little private beaches like there are as Discovery beaches. But it appears in the very first story, it appears in the last story, and several others in between. So it's one of those gathering points.
You know, and the river, do you feel like the river is almost a character in the book?
Yeah, very much. That was intentional. And even when they leave, the boys leave, when they come back, that's what draws them to do something special. You know, and when Lemon and Mickey come back to disperse the ashes of Aggie Robinson, the former sister Mary Agnes, she requests that they disperse her ashes with the sand that she collected from this little beach. They go to the river. And the river is very much the spirit of what these guys carry within them.
Liz called but couldn't stay with us. She's wondering how you were inspired to create the characters with some mental issues, like Dirty Joe or the troubled kid from high school.
Well, there were several of those. I mean, Dirty Joe just kind of arose. I mean, I wanted to deal with...
It's an interesting character, by the way.
Yeah, I wanted to deal with the phenomenon of PTSD from the World War II phenomenon.
Yeah.
Because often that is disregarded as, you know, it was the good war. Nobody suffered when they came back home like they did from Vietnam or the Mideast Wars. So Dirty Joe was this gentleman who was basically spent 3 years in a prison camp in the Philippines and suffered for the rest of his life until he got into a better place. He had to leave Bridgeton to do it. And so that just arose out of nothing. The Lemon sister, Sarah Ruth, who has autism, came about in part because I wanted to develop more of Lemon's family, and also she's autistic, and in that era, autism just was not very much recognized. And then certainly there are others as well that I wouldn't go into, and the kid who is tormented and bullied, who rehabilitates himself, Melvin Trillip. That actually has an interesting origin, and I'll get into that if we have time to do that.
Yeah, well, get into that a
okay,
little bit.
Okay, all right. Well, I was actually kind of in the finishing stages of many of the chapters, and this was in 2018 when the Parkland shooting took place in Florida. And as a retired teacher, I've always been haunted and tormented by shootings, mass shootings in general, but school shootings in particular really undo me to a great extent, and that took place. And, you know, I had to figure out a way to do some version of that in the context of 1961, which is when that story of Melvin Trillip would occur. And so I took this kid who was bullied, and finally he reaches his end, and he's an expert marksman as a trap shooter, and he comes to school with his gun, and he's going to take care of the bullies. And Jimbo and the other two bring him down, but it's primarily Jimbo who can somehow get that gun away from him. But, you know, 10 years later at Melvin's wedding, he says, "I don't know how you did it, because I really intended to shoot somebody and take myself along with that." And he thanks Jimbo for having done that. And Jimbo, and Mickey says to Jimbo, "Why did you do it? And nobody else could have done it." He said, "Well, you know, if he had shot somebody or himself, Bridgeton would never be the same for us."
Yeah. Yeah. It was very impactful and made me think about some of the same kinds of issues and the same kind of feelings I've had myself over the years as a teacher at the University of Wisconsin here. Mike emailed us. He was guessing Mosinee as the setting. As he read Bridgeton, you described it well, bringing out features, yet left the reader wondering a little bit about actual location. Crafting this the way you did allows the reader to imagine the place the story might be in their own hometown. Mike grew up in Iowa, and the story is related so well to any town in Midwest America.
Ah, nice, thanks. I felt that way, that there was a universality about the town, even though it was very specifically Bridgeton / Mosinee. I think the characters could be any town in America, and what happens are just variations of what happens in any town in America. Obviously, the 1950s and the early 60s were a different time than the current moment, but it was simpler, but not necessarily more innocent.
Let's talk about those characters a little more, the three main characters. I'm not sure that we really zeroed in on how they're different and yet similar.
Well, there are the three, and Mickey is the narrator for all but two of the stories. And he is level-headed. He has a father who is very brusque, but also a deeply caring man. And Mickey kind of takes that on. He's kind of a caretaker personality. One of his two best friends, Lemon, is just super intelligent. He's just like a genius type of a character. Graduates high school early and becomes an orthopedic surgeon. And he marries and lives happily ever after, in one sense, and he's very successful. But as a boy, everybody just knew he was really smart and could figure things out very quickly. Jimbo, the third, is really the tormented one. He was abused by his brother very severely, to the point where he spent a school year staying with Mickey and his family because his father basically couldn't control the older brother who was beating him up, all because of the affair Doc had with Beverly, resulting in the baby Lucy, who dies in the early chapter. And so Mickey is the linchpin between the two. It's perhaps predictable that if Mickey weren't there, Lemon and Jimbo might not even be friends. But it's Mickey who holds the triad together, and he's... He just has a way to bring them together, and you can kind of follow that in some of the stories that he's the one. Even when it's Lemon's sister who is abducted, Sarah Ruth, when she's 10 years old, Mickey is the one who's determined to find Dirty Joe, who then leads the search party to finding her in this cave along the river. And a lot of that goes to Mickey's father. His name is Matt in the story, who, despite his brusqueness as a father, he shows Mickey what it is to be a very caring individual.
Yeah, and at that point, Dirty Joe is a very interesting character because he's looked upon in part of the story as this is a kind of an weird ne'er-do-well who drinks too much to becoming a hero at that particular point.
Right, right. No, he's the hero who finds Sarah Ruth, in part by luck, but he had a hunch that she could be in this cave. And then he comes, and finally it's the inspiration of these boys, kind of. Initially, he's just like one of the boys, in a sense, except he drinks. but he lives in the woods in the summertime and sets up a tent, fishes in the river, and because he can't really integrate back into his hometown. And he's got money. His parents have left him money, and they've assigned Mickey's father to manage the money because they didn't trust Joe to handle it because he would drink the money away. But then in one of my favorite passages of the book, Joe is asked to do a presentation on Veterans Day.
Yeah.
And he's never really talked about what happened to him at Cabanatuan in the Philippines, the death camp, and the prison camp there on the death march. And so he's convinced to go, and he can't do it. He never really talks about it in the whole book, which is very common for a lot of veterans. They go their whole lifetimes unable to talk about their war experiences. And so then Mickey's dad, Matt, steps up and delivers his version of what happened to Joe and how nobody comes back from war the same. And Veterans Day should acknowledge that as much as they acknowledge the glories of war.
It is a beautiful passage, for sure, and so yeah, and by the way, Dirty Joe does appear, even though he's not related. He appears kind of here and there throughout.
Yeah, later in the book, you know, he moves to Daytona to basically get away from Bridgeton and try to be straight, and he does. He's a recovering alcoholic. Does the AA route. And then when Mickey's father dies, he comes up to Bridgeton for the funeral and he can barely handle it. And then some years later, he himself dies, and Mickey adds a chapter where he gives Mickey some gifts, and one of the gifts is the eulogy that he wrote when Mickey's father died but couldn't deliver at the kind of the public memorial service. And so that is, and that stimulates... The boys at that point are in their late 50s, but it stimulates them to ponder their own mortality. And that leads Jimbo to, you know, in the letter, Joe says, I felt very sorry for Jimbo because life did not treat him well, and I was always worried about him. And then they question, Jimbo, is that why you've been so unhappy your whole life? And he goes through, no, things just happen, you know, and I've tried to recover, and I have some depression issues, and I've done my best, but there's nothing to pity me about, just like Joe didn't want any pity either.
Bruce emailed us, loved reading Bridgeton, also remembered watching his teenagers drunk driving that was performed in high schools around Wisconsin back in those days.
Oh, yeah. There was a sense of imperviousness of drinking and driving back in the day, for sure.
Yeah, and it probably still goes on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So he viewed, Jimbo viewed Bridgeton quite a bit differently from the other two. And Lemon and Mickey had different, I mean, they all had a little different view of Bridgeton, didn't they?
Yeah, for Mickey, it remains, with its limitations, a very peaceful place. His parents stay there. His father was a local, never left the town except to go to the war and to go to college, came back, had a good job at the paper mill, loses the job, gets another job at another paper mill. His mother is a nurse at the Wausau Hospital. And so it was just kind of this normal hometown. For Lemon, it was as well. But Lemon is just so gifted intellectually that he he views it in a different way. But his sister never left town, and so there's a sense that he's always trying to rescue and save his sister. But for Jimbo, his father came there before Jimbo was born, so he becomes a lifer. But for Jimbo, who's afflicted by depression and just widespread unsuccess in life, it's difficult for him because he feels like he's a failure. But his father, Doc McPherson, really becomes, in the end, even though his father kind of ignored him as a child in many respects, his father becomes then his savior because he teaches him the craft of woodworking. And that becomes Jimbo's gateway into a very happy late-in-life time for himself, and he becomes a real master craftsman selling furniture. And so he can speak about Bridgeton now in a better way, but it's still, there's a bittersweet edge for sure with Jimbo.
Yeah, and I found it interesting that his Jimbo's dad, the Doc, obviously recognized Lemon. He almost treated Lemon like a favored son, and he wasn't a son.
Yeah, right. At one point, Doc hurts himself, and he brings Lemon in to help him deliver services to take notes because he can't use his right hand. And Lemon is like a little bit of a doctor in training, and at one point he says, I didn't have a better teacher than Doc McPherson in all my years of med school and residency.
Michael Knadler, our guest today, his book is titled Bridgeton, and it is our book club book of this part of our season here at Wisconsin Public Radio News. It's great to have him with us. Questions or comments for him? Hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Our book club selection is titled Bridgeton, and we have the author with us today in the studio, Michael Knadler. It's great to have him with us. And we've been having a lot of fun, actually. It's been enjoyable for me to talk with him. And if you have a question or comment or want to join in, I hope you will. Number's 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. Something true to the time period, and I had an experience with it myself, not having polio, but polio. How did polio affect children back in those days?
Well, that was, I don't remember so many specifics, except we were all scared. And so I tried to present that in the story. I wasn't really a friend of hers, but two blocks away there was a girl who did die. And I didn't visit her in the home like I present in the story, where he overcomes his fears and confronts this girl in bed on the brink of going into the hospital to go into the iron lung, and she doesn't survive. But it was just like something in the air. We were all afraid. Everybody would talk about it and was afraid to talk about it at the same time because you didn't know how it could be transmitted. You didn't. It was just like this powerful force. And so I tried to present that in the story, All You Have Is Hope, and because at that point, that's all you felt you could do was hope. Interestingly, at that point in the story, Lemon, who is a real scientific guy who becomes a doctor, goes to the Catholic school, and they pray to not get polio, and they ask God, don't bring polio to us. And at the end, when this girl dies from polio, he becomes very disillusioned. As a 10, 11-year-old, you'd think, well, that's way beyond his thinking at a 10, but he's just a really bright guy, and that becomes his... He said, I don't want to go to the Catholic school anymore. I want to go to the public school because praying did not do anything to solve this problem. I'm going to be a scientist, and those are the people who actually solved it.
Yeah, very affecting. There were some really joyful parts in ways that I smiled about, and you tell it so well. There's, I think it might have been the, you have three sort of segments.
Right.
There's the, you know, their young period, and then the middle period is sort of like high school, and then the third period is they're in their 40s, starting at that point, mm-hmm. roughly. But the in the first segment, the first section of the book, I think it's the last chapter when you talk about 6 feet of snow.
Yeah.
That was, there were some serious things in there and some excitement, but also a lot of joy. And it reminded me of.
Yeah, it was very much a tribute to the phenomenon of a cold, snowy winter, which I remember there being a lot of snow. I mean, it's so different now where there's much, much less snow. But and they are. It's an extraordinary snowfall, and everybody's off of school, and he's part of a group of what are called the junior snowboys. They just go shovel out the driveways and the porches of the people who can't get out and do it themselves. But it's a joyful thing, and it ends with this tribute of they're exhausted after a long day of shoveling and helping Doc get into this home and treat this woman who might be dead, and they have to shovel their way into her home as he makes a house call. And I remember many house calls with my father mm-hmm. back in the day, and so it was a little bit of a tribute to that phenomenon. But in the end, Doc says, if you still got energy, go out and just walk around in the moonlight and look at all this snow. And they do, and they see these houses that look no bigger than dog houses under the snow, and they go down to the skating rink, which is the community gathering point in the winter, and it's being shoveled and plowed, and they skate for several hours, and they stand there as the Chet Parker, who runs the skating rink, plays the finale of Auld Lang Syne, and they hold. And on the way, back home, they just are so exhausted they slip and fall in the snow, and they just start laughing because there's never been a day like it.
Yeah, I love that story, and I frankly remember the skating rink at Cottage Grove, Wisconsin, where guys would bring out the shovels and push the snow away.
Yeah, for sure.
And I could skate with some skates that were too big for me, so my ankles would wobble and everything else, but I enjoyed it a lot. Chuck in Dodgeville has a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Chuck.
Hi. I just wanted to say that in today's world, public education gets frequently criticized by many people, and I just wanted to say I had the good fortune of teaching across the hall in Dodgeville High School uh-huh. from Mike Knadler, and what an excellent teacher he was, and I think it's very apparent by his comments about the book. Bridgeton, you know how good he was, and I know my kids had him as a teacher, and they had so many good things to say about him. So I just wanted to thank him for that.
Thanks, Chuck.
That's have you gotten a lot of? I mean, the book's been out a while now.
I mean,
what kinds of experiences have you had with readers and just people that you've come in contact with as a teacher?
Well, I mean. A number of friends and relatives have read it, and whether they actually liked it or not, they're very nice to me when they give me their reviews. I think many of them actually did like it a lot. But some of the most heartwarming are people I've never met who picked it off a library shelf and read it and said, wow, I couldn't put it down sort of a thing. And so I feel that it accomplished what I was trying to accomplish. And you know, one of the characters in the book related to Chuck's call becomes a teacher, and he tries to, you know, carry on kind of the messages that I had as an adult, where you try to transmit knowledge and experience and a certain amount of wisdom to the kids who sit before you year after year, in my case, 30 years of it. And so teaching is a very undervalued profession, and so I wanted to honor that to some extent in the book.
It's always a pleasure for me to get sometimes a letter, other times nowadays more likely an email from mm-hmm. from a student I might have had even 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah, it happens not so much anymore because I've been out of the game for a while, but I know I had a job for a while in Dodgeville at Land's End where I was the meter and greeter of people at the Land's End Activity Center, and my job was to screen people who were coming in so they wouldn't sneak in or or just to answer phones. And students would come in who I had as students, and they'd be with their wives and children, and we'd end up having a conversation, and I would say something to the effect, you know, with all due respect, you were really a knucklehead in high school. And it really gives me lots of pride to see you, you know, such a responsible guy. And they would laugh, and they say, yeah, I really was a knucklehead.
Oh, my goodness. What makes an experience, good or bad, stick with us throughout our life?
Yeah, no, it's a big question. And while most of these experiences I'm manufacturing from my imagination, the spirit of being affected by something for a life is really, it's a wonderful question. I mean, is it those big moments that predictably people would say, well, of course that would affect you. Somebody really important dying when you're young, or somebody you meet who just kind of transforms you. But remarkably, it's often the little things that you don't even think about as being life changing that become those big moments. And it's different for everybody, and that's the beauty of reflecting back on our lives, because if you were to draw a timeline of your life and highlight it with those big moments, people would probably be very surprised at what you put in that timeline.
Yeah, I was thinking back to, as you were talking, I was thought back to a few times in high school, comments that somebody made offhand that just kind of stuck with me, it feels like I can recall those scenes, and they're just sort of minor, off the cuff comments that actually had. Here I am, all these years later, I can still recall the situation and what was said at the time.
It happened. I had to be, you know, all teachers are aware of what you say and what you don't say, because you never know what's going to linger on with a student later. But on more than one occasion, I would see a former student, and he would say, you know, when you told me at the end of the course that I finally got it in my final paper that I wrote for you, I felt so happy. And I was, you know, saying, well, what about the rest of the semester when you didn't get it? But as he said, it just took me a long time to figure it out.
Yeah.
So you never know what that comment will be that will trigger some great memories.
So what's next for you? Are you going to, somebody, other person emailed and said, are you going to do a sequel? I don't know how you'd sequel that one. But
well, it would have to be much different. It would be, I mean, these guys are alive. Some of the people who were important are no longer alive. But it's a possible. I mean, I think the phenomenon of what happens to people like me or anybody else of my vintage, what happens to us as we get old and try to figure out a great way to live out the rest of our lives is pretty important. And so just tracing them for a few more years would be interesting.
I think it'd be fun. Michael, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Boy, it flew by.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Larry. And thank to all the listeners and
lots
people
of
who wrote notes.
Yeah, I'm sorry we didn't get to all the comments, but that's the way it goes sometimes. Michael Knaedler, our guest, and his book, take a look at it. It's titled Bridgeton, set right here in Wisconsin. And, of course, Michael is right here in Wisconsin himself. So it was great reading it and great having him with us today. And coming up, we're going to switch gears here and talk about some efforts for growing flax and weaving linen right here in Wisconsin. That's next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.